I feel this shift away from product-led growth. You know, it's a bit of a misnomer because it's not product-led growth, it's just self-serve acquisition. And product-led growth goes so far beyond acquisition. It's like a full cycle game that can be totally applied to enterprise complex products that don't even necessarily need to have a free trial. And yes, you can totally have a sales motion and be product-led in your growth strategy. So this is something that I've been trying to kind of educate our prospects, you know, our audience more about in the last few months, because I think it's really harmful to turn away from product-led growth just because self-serve acquisition has been harder this year because of the economic downturn.
So every SaaS company plays for high stakes. But what does it take to dominate the market right now? Welcome to Paris Talks Marketing, the podcast where we dive deep into the latest trends and strategies in SaaS marketing that are really working today. I'm your host, Paris, and our guests are SaaS CMOs, founders, and specialists, and we discuss one trendy topic in the industry per episode. Ready to unlock the true power of marketing strategy? In this theme, we'll explore the world of cutting-edge marketing strategies and tactics that are shaking up the SaaS industry. We'll share insights on testing new tactics and uncover the latest developments from digital landscape giants like Google, Facebook, and LinkedIn. We'll also explore how AI is revolutionizing the digital landscape and transforming marketing tactics. So grab your headphones and get ready for a marketing strategy masterclass with Paris Talks Marketing. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Paris Talks Marketing. And today, my guest is Emilia Korchinska. And Emilia is the head of marketing at UserPilot, a product growth platform for SaaS companies. She's especially interested in product-led growth, product marketing, and content marketing for SaaS companies. So Emilia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Paris. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Great. I would like to start with product-led growth, because this is a topic that your UserPilot is built all around. And I'd like to hear your opinions. I think you have some very strong opinions about the state of PLG, product-led growth, in 2023 and in 2024. What do you think about product-led growth? Where is it headed for SaaS?
Yeah. So you're right. I have quite some strong opinions about it. I actually was writing, I actually sent our weekly newsletter today that was sort of revolving around this topic as well. It's called Product Rants, because I often rant about different products or different like trends and products in it. And PLG is one topic that I rant a lot about recently in particular. The reason for this is that I feel companies, SaaS companies, are turning away from product-led growth, and that there is this trend, like possibly negative trend in the market to shift to enterprise. And we even heard Airbnb, which is kind of like a classic B2C company, say in September that they are going to shift to enterprise. And I feel this sentiment a lot in SaaS, that companies that have obviously struggled this year because it has been a difficult year for the entire tech industry. The high interest rates, the shortage of VC capital, a lot of companies have been hit because other companies in the same industry just didn't have enough budgets to buy tools anymore. So, you know, they kind of assumed that, okay, if we now go upmarket, if we go to enterprise, we're going to have it easier and we will be able to sell even at this pretty low price point to enterprise, because it's easier than trying to sell to smaller companies that may be more hard up at this point in time. And they kind of understand product growth as self-serve acquisition. So essentially, you know, opening the product, offering a free version or a free trial, maybe doing some self-serve onboarding, but that's a maybe. And then essentially the floodgates open, leads flowing in, people checking the product out, and then essentially checking out themselves, and ding, ding, money's falling into the bank account. And this year especially, like a lot of SaaS companies have been disillusioned that it hasn't been the case, right? So I feel this shift away from product-led growth, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer because it's not product-led growth, it's just self-serve acquisition. And product-led growth goes so far beyond acquisition. It's like a full cycle game that can be totally applied to enterprise complex products that don't even necessarily still have a free trial. And yes, you can totally have a sales motion and be product led in your growth strategy. So this is something that I've been trying to kind of educate our prospects, you know, our audience more about in the last few months, because I think it's really harmful to turn away from product led growth just because self-serve acquisition has been harder this year because of the economic downturn.
So you're saying that most people do equate product-led growth with self-serve acquisition, but your opinion is that these are two different things and that product-led growth isn't necessarily self-serve acquisition?
Not an entirely different thing, but self-serve acquisition can be part of the product-led growth playbook, right? So product-led growth is about generating growth through your product. But growth happens at, you know, every stage of the user journey, right? So acquisition is the first, like, part of the funnel, right? If we talk about pirate metrics and the ARRR framework, right? Now we have acquisition, activation, we have retention, we have revenue, right? We have referrals as well. So essentially, this is like a super short-sighted view of product-led growth that takes only this very first stage of the user journey into consideration, right? Okay, after you have acquired users, what about activation? So in the product-led growth mindset, activation would be self-serve, right? Or would be product-led. So the product would have a UX, would have automated onboarding experiences, self-serve onboarding experiences that would allow the users to gain value from the product by using it without having to be constantly assisted in it by customer success, for instance. Or account executives, if activation has to happen before the purchase. Then what about retention? If your users are not engaged, if they're not, for instance, discovering new features in your product to consistently derive more and more value from it, they're more likely to churn. So product-led growth is also about churn prevention and making sure that you retain the revenue that you have already acquired. Moreover, that you drive expansion revenue by, for instance, pushing your users through how the product experience is designed to explore more features or to engage more actively with the features that they're already using if your pricing is usage-based, so that you can push your users to a higher tier of your product or maybe to the next plan, right? And so you can drive expansion revenue. So there is this dichotomy again in the SaaS industry because everyone's raving about NRR, so net retention revenue these days, right? As sort of the antidote to the slowdown in acquisition. And yeah, that's correct. I mean, NRR is a great metric for measuring SaaS health these days. But how do you drive it? Again, there are different ways of doing it. The product-led way is by creating reactive self-serve experiences inside your product that reacts to what the user is doing and prompt them towards adopting more features or increasing their usage so they can ultimately be kind of prompted to upgrade contextually. The sort of traditional way is to deploy, again, account executives, maybe relationship managers to push these users to upgrade, maybe on a call, etc. But like people these days don't want to jump on calls with your account executives, especially if they haven't realized that this value that would push them to upgrade themselves yet. What is the incentive for them to talk to your account representative?
Yeah, I can even say from personal experience with the various SaaS tools that we use, people are reaching out constantly to me, sales reps, or I guess CSMs from these different tools, saying, let's jump on a call. I want to show you what, I don't know, the next tier can do. And I almost never pay attention to those really.
Yeah.
Because it's better if that's it's better if that's revealed to me through the product.
Exactly. So if they, for instance, offered you a reverse trial, right? So they would like offer you to bump yourself up, of course, without like plugging your credit card or anything or like increasing the usage, but just like bump you up to the next tier and show you what you can accomplish on the next tier, knowing your use case already, knowing the features you have already engaged in. Like you would be so much more likely to upgrade. I would bet on it. So yeah. That's an example of product-led growth that happens way past acquisition.
Yeah, it's expansion revenue, and of course, improvement in retention. Yeah. And as the head of marketing at UserPilot, what are you all doing to balance the acquisition challenge with retention and expansion revenue? How are you doing marketing at UserPilot?
So in marketing, we're honestly only responsible for acquisition at this point, to some limited extent, activation and feature adoption, because product marketing is also responsible for feature launches and making sure that the users are informed about the upcoming changes in the product. Mm-hmm. So to an extent, we are involved, but that's to a limited extent. So how do we balance that? It's really a cross-functional and collaborative effort. So marketing essentially drives these qualified leads, make sure they go through the trial, they activate. Actually, we are in charge. So product marketing is also in charge of the trial experience. And we have been recently experimenting with an improved trial experience to improve that trial to paid conversion rate. And then after that, we pass the customers on to the customer success and the way customer success engages with the customers and tries to, again, drive more expansion revenue is by, for instance, differentiating their roles. Mm-hmm. So we have specialized customer success managers that, like, one is specializing in implementation of the tool, one in onboarding and like successful use, and one in the upgrades. And we're also going to be working more on an improved in-app experience that would prompt people to check out the premium features themselves. Like a lot of these POG plays, we're still yet to try ourselves. We are actually experimenting with a few. So for instance, the reverse trial that I mentioned, we are doing reverse trials of the growth plan. So this is the higher tier with premium features available. So any trial user can request to be bumped up to the growth plan and experience the higher value even before they have converted into a paying customer.
Got it. For acquisition, the first thing I think about is the difference between demand fulfillment and demand generation and or demand capture. So on the demand capture side, that would be primarily paid search, starting with paid search or other forms of intent. That could include SEO too. But how much are you seeing? Because when I look at UserPilot, it doesn't fall neatly into an existing SaaS category. I checked you out on G2 and you're lumped together with digital adoption platforms, which to me seems very, very broad and generic. So if the first question is really how many people are looking for your solution in terms of their search intent? And are you able to capture that versus how much of your efforts are going more towards generating demand by educating people about the solution that you offer?
I would say still the majority of our efforts go into capturing demand. So even though there is no established category for, say, product-led growth tools or product growth platforms, as we call UserPilot on, you know, review platforms like G2 or Capterra, there is a lot of demand for the different jobs to be done that basically UserPilot serves. So this can be user onboarding, could be feature adoption, this can be product analytics, collecting user feedback. We are covering a lot of these different use cases. So we are very strong in terms of SEO and in terms of organic acquisition through our blog content. We publish a ton of content every month. Like, I think this month we went over 130 new blog posts that were published on our blog.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, we're pretty good at capturing demand. When it comes to generating demand, this year we started experimenting with, I mean, not experimenting, we started running webinars consistently. So every 2 weeks, we run a webinar around the topics that we know are converting from organic, but like trying to educate the audience that we weren't able to reach with our organic content still. We also run an industry conference product drive that essentially touches upon a lot of different related topics. So not necessarily just of the keywords that are converting, but also more like thought leadership content that would maybe inspire some of our audience that hasn't been convinced that they need a product growth platform, that that's important, and that, you know, as we discussed at the beginning, product-led growth is not only about self-serve acquisition. And yeah, the product rents newsletter is another demand gen play. Again, discussing these issues kind of in a high level from different perspectives, discussing these controversies in the market and trying to maybe sway the audience towards trying a solution like that.
Yeah. I'm going to share my screen for a minute, and most of the listeners won't see this, but if you're watching on YouTube, you will. And I want to show the organic traffic growth. And this is a content marketer's dream, really. This is the last 2 years. So you mentioned the high volume of content that you've produced, about 130 blogs per month. So a couple of years ago, organic traffic was around 5,000 per month. But today, you're approaching, at least according to Ahrefs, you're approaching 80 or 100,000. Maybe in reality, you're way over that.
Over a year ago now. So yeah, it's closer to double that figure. So, it's, okay. Yeah, it is over double that, actually.
That's amazing. And I mean, this is just such a testament to SEO and to content marketing. I think a lot of people have given up on that. And especially now in this new age of AI-generated content, I think people are also getting discouraged that, is it still worth it for me to produce this high volume of content when I may be competing against AI-generated content? And in particular, I want to go there a little bit. The content that you're producing, so 130 blog posts, could you walk me through the workflow about how you're able to produce such a high volume? Are you, do you have an editorial calendar? And then is there any strategy that goes into the planning of these blog posts, and then how are they created?
Yeah, totally. I spoke about it like a few times already. So currently, actually, we have two motions of how we produce content. I'm not personally managing the content team myself. So we have a head of content now that handles that. But we were like sort of both in the trenches of this for the first year, laying the foundation. And now she's like very bravely building upon that. So the first motion is essentially original content that is written by freelance writers who get very, very detailed briefs from our in-house editors. So we currently have 5 in-house editors who produce between, well, it depends on the editor, but 2 to 4 briefs per week each, right? Mm-hmm. So these are the briefs for the writers. So say on average, 3 briefs times 5 editors, that's 60 pieces of content per month, right? Where like 20 working days or 4 weeks, essentially. So then the writers write this up, the piece of content goes back to the editors check it against the original brief and the quality standards. So our SEO checklist, content publication checklist, and then the piece of content goes to a editor publisher who then checks again for any language issues and again against the SEO checklist before ultimately publishing the piece to our blog and several distribution platforms that we like push the content to, so our social media, our Medium account, etc. So that's the original content motion. And then the second motion is programmatic SEO content. It's still original content, but it's produced in a different way. So that content is produced from templates that we have built with Google Sheets and like various Excel formulas that essentially cater to these very repetitive keywords, typically at the bottom of the funnel. For instance, best tool for use case alternatives, right? Or tool one versus tool two, or tool alternatives, or best tools for persona. These types of blog posts follow very sort of formulaic patterns, and the outline of the blog can be captured in a template, right? So we create these templates with Google Sheets, and then we fill in the content of these templates with information from our databases. So we have databases on all the different tools in the market,
that are like very, very granular, breaking the tools down by different use cases, jobs to be done, features, and then including different screenshots, et cetera, et cetera. And these databases, again, are filled. Well, initially they were filled by our editors. Now they are filled by our writers. So we're going to pay them a similar rate to what we would have paid them for an original post. The difference is that one database entry can be used to populate dozens of templates. So that allows us to pick and mix the different pieces of information from the two databases that we have. So a tools database and a use case database to compose posts that, you know, recycle some bits of content, but essentially are human written and serve the search intent very, very accurately. So that's kind of where another roughly 40% of our content production comes from. So the target is typically around 100 blogs per month. Last month, we managed to go over the target because we produced actually a lot more of these programmatic posts.
That's fascinating. So it's about 60% all human process led, and then the other is the 40% programmatic. And does that programmatic involve the use of generative AI tools in any way, any kind of AI writing assistance?
Not really, not at this point. And it's still human-led. It's just a different process. It's a lot more scalable than the original.
It's more template-driven.
Yeah, we have tried using AI for this. We have tried implementing it in the templates. But at this point, you know, especially for these super bottom-of-the-funnel keywords that require actual experience with the tools, so that's part of the Google Eats metric, right? You really need to have hands-on experience with the tools you're writing about for these very specific use cases, right? You can ask ChatGPT these questions, but the answers it will provide you will be sort of very generic, right? So we don't currently use it a lot for that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, a quick word from our sponsor. The Paris Talks Marketing Show is affiliated with Hop Online, a performance marketing agency focused on high-growth SaaS and other recurring revenue-based companies. If you like the flow of this conversation, you may want to consider jumping on a discovery call with someone at Hop Online. A discovery call is similar to my podcast interviews in a lot of ways. We'll get to know your business goals, competitive landscape, and marketing needs. And you'll almost certainly come away with some new ideas for how to accelerate your customer and revenue growth. If you're interested, go to hop.online, that's hop.online, and book a discovery call with one of our strategists today. Now, back to the episode. Are you generally measuring the results from each type to see the efficacy?
We are. We have had a lot of issues with attribution this year because of all the changes that happened with like migrating from Universal Analytics to GA4. Then internally, we were also changing our tools for demo bookings, for instance. So at some point, we had a bit of a breakdown in attribution because we had to create a different attribution model for our blog posts based on a different event. But before that happened, we saw like a 3 times higher conversion rate on the programmatic posts by virtue of them being very bottom of the funnel. That's not to say that this was the majority of our conversions. This was still, you know, like a small, I would say, fraction, because these posts tend to have very limited search volume. They're very, very niche. Yeah. They're extremely specific. So the idea here is that we want to cover all the bases and be present in SERPs for all the different combinations of tools and use cases. And yeah, it's sort of a compound interest that it adds up over time, but it's not our like sole or main driver of acquisition from organic.
Okay. But that's still a pretty impressive, or it's very interesting that there's a 3 times higher conversion rate from something that is the most scalable aspect of the content marketing. I guess you also, maybe it's not fair to judge the conversion rate of a bottom of funnel term versus more of an educational term, because you mentioned the attribution challenges. It may be that the stuff, the 60% that is created outside of the templates, that's more of a longer journey where people are not really expected to convert into free trials right after reading the first post.
Maybe they'll
become aware of the brand. Well, how do you tackle that attribution then? Because it seems like if I were to look at this on the face of it, I would say, oh, double down on the template driven content, because it has a 3 times higher conversion rate. Let's do more of that. And let's do less of the middle to upper funnel type of content. How do you deal with that attribution challenge? How do you attribute the value for that top of funnel content?
Yeah, you know, so attributing value is not just limited to conversions, right? Because as you mentioned, mm-hmm. it's not just about the last touch conversions. It's also about educating the market. It's also about nurturing the leads and in general, kind of increasing the brand visibility. So that's one. Besides what you said about the programmatic method being more of the most scalable, it's actually not so scalable because of the limitations in terms of search volume and the limitation mm-hmm. in terms of the keyword combinations that you can realistically use for the programmatic template. So they have to fit mm-hmm. into a certain pattern, right? Which mostly revolves around what you have in your databases. It only makes sense to create these databases if you can use one row in the database, so one entry for multiple different blog posts, multiple different keyword combinations and templates. So a lot of keywords, even if they follow a formulaic pattern, still wouldn't make sense to create a programmatic SEO database for them, right? Mm-hmm. Because, for instance, they would only be used in one template. So you need to look for opportunities where you could combine two databases to create multiple blogs. And we have done that. But so far, we've been only able to use tools database and use case database. Luckily enough, we are a pretty complex platform. So there are tons of use cases and tons mm-hmm. of tools that some way or another are our direct or indirect competitors. So that's still a lot of content. But for mm-hmm. some other solutions, other tools, it could be a lot less content, right? So mm-hmm. I wouldn't encourage anyone to just like do programmatic SEO because it's limited and it's short-sighted because it doesn't include what I mentioned at the beginning or the other benefits of producing mid to top of the funnel content. Yeah, we aren't really attributing all the touches in the conversion funnel mm-hmm. in terms of content. That would be a complicated attribution model. And with our team size, like we don't really see a lot of value in this at this point. So kind of learn how our users really progress through the different blogs. And if they do, I don't think that would influence our or inform our content strategy a lot. So we don't currently do that.
Yeah, that is pretty complicated to try to map out all the touch points from blogs. If they started with a blog post or maybe they touched a blog at the middle of the journey somehow. But I agree, if you only focus on the bottom of the funnel, at some point you will saturate that and you've got to move up towards the middle and top of funnel and educate the market and open it up. I suppose, I mean, one way in Google Analytics would just be to look at all the conversions and to see of all total conversions, how many of those paths at least had one touch on a blog post. But even that would just give you kind of an idea. It wouldn't give you any really quantitative attribution value to those blog posts, but it could show just generally how many were involved as assisted touches in their conversion path.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of thought exercise I can think of how machine learning models could be used to evaluate mm-hmm. these paths and to maybe assign weight to different blogs. So you could mm-hmm. make a more informed decision, say, which types of topics or what kind of posts contribute most to conversions, even if they don't drive conversions themselves. But again, like I'm not aware of a tool that does it at this point.
Neither am I. Yeah. I think content marketers have been trying to solve this one for at least 15 years plus.
Yeah, and it's also so hard. Like with like identity resolution issues and cross-device mm-hmm. issues, for instance, I think it would be super hard to attribute it accurately. Yeah, I feel like we know our audience quite well. So we also know more or less where we have content gaps, right? So which areas mm-hmm. of the product we haven't really covered so much in terms of content because they are, for instance, new. So that's kind of what guides our content planning more than data from Google Analytics in that respect, in terms of paths, yeah, at least.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And we really have dove deep into content marketing, but you all are really crushing it on organic content. And it's just an amazing success story. So I think to all the listeners out there that have given up, or if you think that generative AI content has really ruined the game for SEO and content marketing, I think not quite. I think it's still, at least Google is still able to really understand unique content that comes from real users. And as you said, the use cases is something that you can't get out of ChatGPT today. So I would say keep thinking about the unique value and insights that don't exist today that you can blog about, because that's the stuff that I think that Google is looking to find and surface and rank.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. Well, this has been fantastic, Emilia. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wished I would have asked you, or is there anything else that you think would benefit our audience?
Not off the top of my mind. Yeah, it was great chatting with you as well. I hope this was useful. We kind of, yeah, as you said, touched upon a lot of different topics, from the state of PLG to the state of organic content. Yeah, maybe just like one last passing thought. I think, yeah, that generative AI and all the AI writing tools have made content more difficult. And in general, the content game is getting more and more difficult. So we have the luxury of being where we are because we have been so, so consistent for such a long time. And I would say there are very few teams that produce even annually what we produce monthly. So we kind of decided to put all our eggs in one basket at some point, and that allowed us to get ahead. But yeah, I do see how companies that, like, I know Wolf because I have like a Patreon community, and they come to me with like certain questions or issues. And when I advise them, I see like how companies struggle to cut through the noise and break through these days if they don't have a high domain authority, right? And a lot of resources to produce as much content as we do.
Yeah,
I think it is getting harder, but
absolutely. That has given you all such a defensive moat. There's no competitor that can replicate that in a short period of time.
I just do hope it won't be wiped out by generative search, right? Because honestly, I don't know what it will look like, what also the like legal issues, how they will be resolved in terms of copyright and content ownership by Google. I do see all that it will change SEO a lot in the next couple of years. For now, I think it's time to also look for another moat and hedge our bets a bit more.
Yeah. Well, I remember that the CMO from Jasper, who spoke at SaaS Talk, where we met a couple of weeks ago, she predicted that around 25% of SEO traffic will be gone in the next couple of years. I don't know where that came from, but I do think it's not unreasonable to assume there could be as much as that.
Okay, I can live with 25. 25% is pretty optimistic.
Yeah, that still leaves a lot left. I mean, yeah, it could be worse, but it does. I think it will depend a lot on the type of searches.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But I think the transactional searches, so the ones that actually contribute to most conversions, will most likely be wiped out. So we may want to brace ourselves, because currently the search experience is often so bad. You know, think of any situation where you were looking for a very simple answer to a very specific question. Like, I don't know, how to change a light bulb in a specific fridge model, right? And then you're weeding through all these search results that aren't either specific or actionable enough for you to be able to do what you came for. And I think Google users have that experience a lot, and it's a frustrating experience. So Google will have to look into resolving it. Whoever resolves it first and is able to navigate the legal challenges of this as well will win at, you know, SEO game. So we're not SEO, but like at basically monopolizing search moving forward.
Yeah. I think, yeah, the percentage of zero-click searches, it's already been growing steadily for the last few years, but I think it's going to take a big, big leap if Google really decides to start pushing the search generative experience. I mean, they're almost really discouraging you from scrolling down past the answer. They really want to just give you the answer and send you on your way, but they're not there to send traffic to websites anymore, for sure.
No,
I don't think Google ever really felt that that was their obligation, really.
No, I mean, that's traffic. Also what the users want, right? So when, like, from the user perspective, we want to get specific answers to our questions as quickly as possible without having to click through dozens of websites and without having to think too much.
Yeah. Well, do you all have a backup plan in the next 1 or 2 years if, I don't know, if a big portion of that traffic gets wiped out?
Yeah, we do. I'm bracing myself. I'm already like doing research that will lead into this new channel. So we're looking into ABM and kind of a more old school approach of like essentially going outbound. But I don't see it as old school again. So we definitely are going to reinvent the process and make it a lot more helpful in the end, I hope.
Yeah, I do think that ABM could be one of the answers if SEO takes a major hit. I've been looking into platforms like ZooInfo and Sixth Sense, and they also have a treasure trove of data, intent type of data that they're sourcing from various places that can tell you when someone is potentially in market and it's the right time to reach out. So it still is outbound, but it's outbound with hyper-personalization. It's not blasting cold emails or spamming people or anything like that. It's going after a relatively small list of target accounts when the signals say that they're ready to receive your message and then to do so in a highly personalized way. And I think that even that will also be very much assisted by AI, that the personalization aspects of that.
Yeah,
and that's exciting also. A new exciting area of marketing is the hyper-personalized outbound and ABM. So yeah, I guess that's a good thing to start planning for, because I do think at some point the nature of searches is really going to change.
Mm, yeah, it's an exciting but also stressful time for marketers, because there are so many unknowns in the equation that it's hard to plan, it's hard to budget in the year ahead. So yeah, for us it will be mostly about continuing doing what we have been successful at so far, but like layering another channel on top so we can build another moat in case SEO gets a hit.
Yeah, it's great that you all have that foresight and are looking ahead. I think most SaaS companies are not where you are in that respect. Great. Well, that was we were wrapping up about 10 plus minutes ago, but that was a great way to end it. And Emilia, thanks so much for being with us today, and can't wait to publish this episode. It's been great.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Baris. Looking forward.
Thanks. Another great episode in the books. Hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get notified when future episodes drop, be sure to subscribe to Baris Talks Marketing on your favorite podcast player. And to learn more about our growth marketing agency, visit hop.online. That's hop.online. Have a great day.